Ortega. She's the bilingual director for United Teachers Los Angeles. Welcome to Politics or Pedagogy.
Thank you, John. Nice to be here.
Starting in January of this year, cursive handwriting has become something that teachers in California are expected to teach. Tell us about your experience with cursive handwriting.
It was determined that on standardized tests where your answers are filled in with bubbles, that there's no way to test handwriting. It's not multiple choice. You have to see the product. You have to see the handwriting. And people aren't giving out tests like that anymore. So since you can't test it, there's no reason to teach it. I mean, that was the actual philosophy of why they stopped teaching cursive handwriting. I can't even think of a reason other than that. Why would you think it's not a good skill to have? I know from people who are psychologists, people who are artists, people who are therapists, who tell me about all of the positive brain connection between eye, hand, brain in teaching cursive handwriting. Other than the practical of having your own signature, of reading old documents, all of that is completely accurate. But other than the untestableness of it, I don't understand why it was ever dropped from curriculum.
As a classroom teacher, how would you go about teaching cursive?
First of all, you teach children manuscript writing, you know, block print writing. Cursive is manuscript writing with little connections in between, you know, little curved lines that connect, you know, the L to the I in little, which makes it not only flowing, but faster to do. And you teach children how to use their hands. You teach children how to draw circles, how to draw straight lines up and down, and then how to connect those circles and those lines, and those turn into letters. It's really not a genius thing to teach. It's just it's a thing that requires practice. And, you know, I mean, some people decry teaching programs that require practice, but the fact is you just don't learn things unless you practice them. Like, you know, like learning music, you have to practice scales. And, you know, if you want to run competitively, you have to practice working out. So everything you want to do well requires practice.
On that note, Cheryl Ortega, thank you very much for joining us on Politics or Pedagogy.
It was a pleasure. Thank you, John.
Thank you. Please make your contribution at 818-985-5735 or pledge online at kpfk.org.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
Good afternoon, and welcome to Middle East in Focus. I'm Esti Chandler. Nearly 2 weeks ago, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu caught the attention of Western diplomats by announcing that the Israeli military plans to shift its focus from Gaza to Lebanon. Perhaps it was to distract attention from his government's announcement of 5,300 new housing units in illegal West Bank settlements in the same week they approved what Israeli NGO Peace Now is calling the largest land seizure in the West Bank in over 30 years. But on Wednesday, Israeli forces killed a senior Hezbollah commander in a drone strike in southern Lebanon, prompting retaliation in the form of a heavy cross-border rocket barrage that went back and forth for days. This escalation came as Western diplomats continue working to try to avoid a full-scale war between Israel and Hezbollah, a danger that has alarmed them since last October and has increased in recent weeks. Cross-border exchanges of fire between Israeli and Hezbollah forces that have escalated in recent months did so again as Netanyahu and other Israeli officials continue speaking publicly about shifting their military focus from Gaza to Hezbollah, a far more advanced and potent threat to them than Hamas. We are all very fortunate to have Palestinian-American journalist, author, and academic Rami Khoury with us today to discuss Hezbollah, how the balance of power has shifted in the region, the potential of a full-scale war with Hezbollah expanding into a wider regional war. Rami George Khoury is a Palestinian-American academic and journalist. He's a distinguished fellow at the Issam Fares Institute for Public Policy and International Affairs, which he founded at the American University of Beirut. He's also a non-resident senior fellow at the Arab Center in Washington, D.C., and writes a weekly op-ed for Al Jazeera Online. During his 50 years in journalism, Rami Khoury published an internationally syndicated column, edited the Jordan Times and the Beirut Daily Star newspapers, and wrote from the Middle East for the Financial Times, the Boston Globe, and the Washington Post, while contributing commentaries at NPR and BBC Radio, among other news outlets. It is my great pleasure to welcome Rami Khoury to Middle East in Focus.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Rami, I think that many people don't really know very much at all about Hezbollah beyond the way Israeli propaganda has defined it. So I wonder if you could start by giving us a brief background on Hezbollah, how and when they formed, the role they play in Lebanese society, and perhaps how they are different from Hamas.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be with you. The main thing to understand about Hezbollah is that it came into being in the early 1980s after more than a decade and a half of the Israelis attacking southern Lebanon, sometimes because they wanted to attack Palestinian groups who were there, sometimes just to harass the Lebanese. Some people say the Israelis wanted to control the Litani River waters. There are different reasons. But the Lebanese government could not defend the south of Lebanon from the Israelis, who would bomb Beirut airport, put it out of commission, and do other things. So finally, Hezbollah emerged as the most powerful indigenous Lebanese military resistance and defense force. And they became very strong. They became the strongest military force in Lebanon. And they were supported by Shiites all over the world and many other people who are not Shiites who supported the way that Hezbollah pushed back against the Israelis and eventually pushed them out of Lebanon. Around, I think it was 2000, they were pushed out. And the Israelis had occupied southern Lebanon. They set up a zone where they financed and protected an Israeli and Lebanese militia. They called it the South Lebanese Army. They tried every trick in the book to basically maintain full control of that area. And they couldn't because Hezbollah fought back and became strong. And there are other groups besides Hezbollah. Leftist groups, Palestinian groups, Arab nationalist groups. It wasn't the only one fighting, but it was became the main one. And they succeeded. They drove Israel out of Lebanon. And then there were several, between 2000 and today, there were several major military clashes between Hezbollah and Israel. And in 2006 was the biggest one, I believe, the last one. And I was there in Lebanon for that. And it was essentially a draw. There was terrible destruction throughout Lebanon. Israel destroyed all kinds of public facilities, water, power, airport, etc. And the result was that Israel had to accept a ceasefire. And the situation ever since has been that there's a kind of mutual deterrence along the Israel-Lebanon border because Hezbollah is so strong militarily. And it's strong militarily because it is a very serious organization. Whether you like them or not, you have to respect what they've been able to do with their technical and military prowess and their determination to resist. And they had tremendous support from Iran in the beginning, in the early 80s. Iran gave them a lot of support, technically and otherwise. But they are a Lebanese resistance movement. They call themselves the Muqawama, which means the resistance. They've become the biggest military force in Lebanon, and the most important political force. They entered Lebanese politics some time ago. They stayed out of Lebanese politics for many years, but then they felt they needed to be involved. So they have members of parliament. They have members in the cabinet. They're an essential voice that has to approve any major appointment, like a new president, a new head of the armed forces. So they have essentially veto power over any major Lebanese decision. And that bothers a lot of Lebanese who don't think this is correct. But this is the situation. Many Lebanese like it, many Lebanese don't like it. But they are there, they're powerful, they're continuing their work, and they have now, because of the Gaza situation, the Israeli assault on Gaza, the Hezbollah said, announced back in October, that it would increase its actions, military actions against Israel, a small amount, essentially harassing Israel across northern Israel, as a way to distract Israel from Gaza, to preoccupy a lot of its troops and equipment, to drive citizens out of the north of Israel. About 60, 70,000 have been relocated, to cause problems for Israel on many fronts, as a way of supporting Hamas. Hezbollah doesn't want to get into a full-fledged war with Israel, so this is what it saw as its best move to show support for Hamas in a practical way without igniting a full-fledged war. And that's basically where we are now. The last thing I'd say is that you have to understand that Hezbollah and Hamas and Ansarullah, the Houthis in Yemen, they have become very prominent and impactful, partly because they've coordinated their actions together. They certainly coordinate their training and their military capabilities and all that, manufacturing weapons, I imagine. And they are very strong together, and they call themselves the Axis of Resistance. And that means they share the philosophy that they need to push back against Israeli aggression in Palestine and Lebanon and elsewhere, because Israel has attacked Iraq, it's attacked Syria, it's attacked all kinds of places in the Arab world, and the resistance against the United States. They see U.S. as the main power behind Israel, as we see in the genocide in Gaza now. This is the situation. So the Axis of Resistance is a regional military coordinated force that is very close to Iran, but acts always on the basis of Arab national interests as they see it. And this is where we are now. And this situation probably will keep evolving. But right now, the Arab Axis of Resistance is the only one that has really forced the Israelis to do things that it doesn't want to do. It forced them into ceasefires. It forced them into prisoner exchanges. It has forced Israel into not starting a full war in Lebanon so far. So they have to be respected for their military power. And in Lebanon, they're very controversial. Like I said, half the population really loves them and half the population doesn't like them. They don't like the fact that they're closely allied to Iran, and they see people who dislike Hezbollah criticize it as pushing a Shiite agenda, which doesn't help all the other Lebanese. Hezbollah denies that. It insists that it's working for the benefit of all Lebanese, but this is an internal Lebanese issue that will be resolved one day.
You're listening to Middle East in Focus on listener-supported KPFK Radio here in Los Angeles. I'm Esti Chandler, very happy to be joined today by Palestinian-American academic and journalist Rami Khoury, distinguished fellow at the Institute for Public Policy and International Affairs at the American University of Beirut. We're discussing Hezbollah, Netanyahu's reaction to their recent release of surveillance videos, and ways the balance of power has shifted in the Middle East. So for all the reasons you said, Rami, Hezbollah remains central to international discussions of Israel's massive attack on Gaza, expanding into a broader regional conflict that is causes so much concern to American officials and their allies. I believe it was just prior to Netanyahu's recent announcement about moving focus that Hezbollah released some videos taken by surveillance drones. Can you discuss Hezbollah's capabilities and whether you believe those videos being released are, in fact, what motivated Netanyahu's remarks?
Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that the videos released by Hezbollah were a very powerful, practical example of the kinds of messaging it does to the Israelis. And in this case, they were showing the Israelis their ability to survey, fly over, and target any target in in central or northern Israel that they want. They can get through the Israeli defenses. They did it this time only with a drone with video cameras, but they can do it with a drone or with other missiles maybe and inflict a lot of damage. They showed pictures of Haifa port, of the, I think, the Dimona nuclear reactor, of military bases all over the north, major cities. So this is an important dimension of Hezbollah's current situation. The reason it is so powerful and it is taken seriously is that it has developed, partly on its own, partly with Iranian assistance and partly with other assistance around the world, we don't know. But they have very, very sophisticated military capabilities now, including intelligence gathering, communications, ballistic missiles, drone technology. They have all kinds of highly capable military capabilities that they're not afraid to use either if they get into a larger confrontation. They've already shown examples of this by attacking smaller targets all across northern Israel, army bases, monitoring, electronic monitoring stations. They've sent some drone attacks, set off forest fires here and there. So they've shown very clearly with their actions and with the video what they can do. And they claim they have a lot more technical, new technology, military technology that they haven't shown yet. And the thing about Hezbollah that one should be aware of is, from my experience, and I've followed them since they began operating in the early 80s, I've met Hezbollah leaders in Lebanon many times, and they are people who do what they say. If they say we're going to do this, then they will do it. They have the ability to do it, and they have the political will to do it. And they've shown this over the years. Israel understands this now, and therefore the Israelis are being cautious. Now, Netanyahu, has used all kinds of tactics to try to save his skin because he's wanted for all kinds of corruption charges. And if the war ends in Gaza, he's going to be in court the next day. But Netanyahu is desperately trying to create new diversionary tactics to get people's attentions away from three or four things that are catastrophic for Israel. One is that it's been unable to achieve its main goals in Gaza, which is to destroy Hamas. The Hamas forces are still fighting back on a daily basis. It's been unable to drive the Palestinians out of Gaza, which it would like to do. It would like to just push them into the Sinai, which is part of the old Zionist, continuing Zionist philosophy of occupying all the land of historic Palestine for the Jewish people only, for the Jewish state Israel. But they've been unable to do that. They've lost tremendous respect and support all around the world, especially the global south and among progressive people in the north. You see this in UN votes where, the vote is 150-7, against Israel and for Palestinian rights. You see it in these amazing demonstrations all over the world, nonstop for the last 9 months, but going back many, many years. You see it in the tremendous movement of student protests that started in the U.S. and spread through encampments all across the world, but especially North America and Europe. They've been taken to court by the two highest authorities, the legal authorities, the International Court of Justice and the International Criminal Court. Have both taken decisions against Israel or basically saying Israel is committing genocide and therefore needs to be stopped. Israel, of course, ignores international law and it keeps doing whatever it wants to do, which increases the animosity against it to the point where it got into a very brief verbal duel with the American president, Joe Biden, which really wasn't very serious, but it was theatrics on the part of the Americans more than anything else, that we're angry with the Israelis. We're going to suspend our weapons for a few weeks that allow Israel to kill 40,000 people and destroy all of Gaza. But that wasn't a serious American move. It was theatrics. But it was a sign that in the United States, there is significant erosion of support for Israel. You see it in the electoral campaign. You see it in the youth movement. You see the polling evidence from pollsters repeatedly showing that young people, even especially young Jews, people under the age of, say, 35, are heavily, heavily in favor of Palestinian rights and an American policy that serves both Israel and Palestine equally, but also serves the law, observing the requirements of international law. So Israel is in a big mess politically, diplomatically, militarily in Gaza. And the last point is that the Israeli army is really fatigued. It's running out of ammunition. Its own generals have said this recently. The morale is very low. Many reservists are not reporting when they're called up a second or third time. The Israeli army needs a rest and other things. But the Netanyahu government is basically trying to whip up tension on the Lebanon border and saying it's going to attack Lebanon because Hezbollah is the real danger, which they've said for many years. That Israel has seen Hezbollah for decades as the most dangerous threat to it, because of its capabilities and because of its links with Iran. So the Netanyahu strategy is to threaten, we're going to go attack Lebanon, we're going to destroy Hezbollah, we're going to send Beirut back into the Stone Age. I don't think they're going to do all these things. They've done pinprick attacks here and there, and this has been the situation for the last 20 years between Lebanon and Israel, that one side kills a soldier, the other side kills a soldier. One attacks a village, the other attacks a village. But the Israelis have raised the rhetoric really sharply, and I think it's also theatrics and a sign of the desperation that I think drives most of the policymaking in Israel today. They don't know quite what to do. The military brass is at odds with Netanyahu. Netanyahu is at odds with Biden and many people in the West. The Jews around the world do not support the genocide that Netanyahu is carrying out. They want a ceasefire. So this is this should be seen as one more diversionary tactic by Netanyahu. But this is typical of the Zionist actions over the last century, where they desperately take action to make sure that the focus of the world is on other people who are the bad guys. Years ago, it was Saddam Hussein. Then it was, before that, it was the PLO. Before then, it was Al-Qaeda and ISIS. Then it was Hamas and Hezbollah. That they keep finding, the Israelis keep highlighting new great threats. And Iran, of course, has always been a big problem for them. And they want the world to focus on these threats against Israel. Some of them are threats, most of them are not. And it doesn't, the Israelis desperately want to avoid the world analyzing Israel and its policies and the ethics of Zionism and the legacy of Zionist actions since this conflict started in 1915 or so, for the last century. And this is yet one more move by the leader of Israel to divert people's attention away from what Israel is still doing in genocide, which is killing 30, 40, 50 people a year, bombing civilians in tents, sheltering in UNRWA schools, prohibiting hundreds of tons of relief supplies to enter Gaza. All the things it's been doing since October, it's continuing to do, and the Western media is reporting it much less.
That's right. In spite of the fact that not only are Israeli military leaders calling for a ceasefire, but hundreds of thousands of Israeli citizens are out in the streets calling for a ceasefire. In our last few minutes, Rami, in your column at Al Jazeera early this week was titled "Watching the Watchdogs: Palestinians Resist Unprecedented Silencing." I wonder if there's a connection that you can make for us between the formidable challenge that Hezbollah presents to Israel, expanding its war amid massive state suppression of Palestinians and supporters for Palestinian liberation and equality in the U.S., while we're also witnessing massive growth, as you said, of the global Palestine solidarity movement, including the broad mobilization against anti-Palestinian racism here in the U.S.
Yes, that's an important point, and it's really become more and more clear in the last 6 to 8 months, when we've seen that Israel, in cahoots with the American government, in cahoots with the mainstream American and Canadian and Western media, have tried to push this line that there's now a great new anti-Semitic wave around the world. Hamas is leading this. People in the West who support a ceasefire are supporting Hamas, are supporting genocide against the Jews. Anti-Semitism is driving Jewish people nuts because they're afraid to go to college. All of this is part of a propaganda campaign. Some of it is true at a small level, but when they exaggerate it like this, they then try to get the American government and their friends in the West, who are dwindling now. They don't have as many friends in the West as they did before, but there are still a lot of people who support Israel, and they're trying to silence the Palestinians. They're trying to do what the Zionists did with the British when they passed the Balfour Declaration in 1917 to start this conflict, when the British said, we will support a Jewish home in Palestine. Palestine was 93% Palestinian Arab, about 7% Jewish. Indigenous there. And the Western power then, Great Britain, basically went along with the Israeli plan to make the Palestinian people disappear from history, make them invisible people. We're seeing this happening today now with the U.S. as a major Western imperial power, working with the Israeli government, doing the same thing, and working with pro-Israeli extremists in the U.S., in the Congress, in the universities, elsewhere. This is not going to work because the trend in every other dimension of life and public opinion and politics and power and sentiment is for a legitimate resistance against Israel and legitimate support for Palestinian rights on an equal basis with Israel, and whatever the two people decide, two states, one state, joint state, confederal states, that's up to the Israelis and Palestinians to decide. So that's where we are today. And the Israelis and their American friends are going to be increasingly seeing that they're not going to be able to succeed in this campaign, simply because we have, for the first time in 100 years, a serious coordinated international movement to support Palestinian rights, pushing back in every sphere, legal action, public opinion, media, universities, polling, street demonstrations, in every field, UN work, there's pushback now against the Zionists as there never was before. And the Israelis don't quite know how to handle this, and this is the stage we're at now.
Rami, we can't thank you enough for taking time out of your weekend to clarify some things that you just aren't hearing enough about in mainstream U.S. corporate-owned media. So we're very grateful for your expertise, and don't be surprised when we call you and ask you back again soon.
Well, I'd be very happy to do that. Thank you for your good work, and there is now a lot more accurate information available on the web and alternative media and progressive media. So people can find now the information they need, which still doesn't permeate the mainstream media, as you said, but the dam is beginning to crack. So the truth will come out, and we're starting to see this thanks to people like you and others who insist on sharing the truth.
Appreciate you very much. As Rami Kori pointed out recently, in an article for The Guardian, Brooklyn College professor Mostafa Bayoumi wrote that anti-Palestinianism has been fueling institutionalized American Islamophobia for decades, with U.S. authorities putting significant efforts into surveilling and suppressing pro-Palestinian Arab-American organizing since 1967. He argues that today's crackdown on pro-Palestinian voices and activism is the culmination of these historical efforts, writing, quote, "Significantly, the young Muslim Americans and Jewish Americans who are at the center of today's protest movements are placing Palestinian rights back in the struggle to defeat Islamophobia." Why? Freedom. These young people recognize that to free the U.S. from its anti-Muslim and anti-Jewish prejudices requires freeing the Palestinian people from their oppression. This is not a position just for the moment. It's a lesson about overcoming oppression worldwide. End quote. Once again, I want to thank our guest, Palestinian-American academic and journalist Rami Khoury. You can read his weekly op-ed at Al Jazeera Online. I also want to thank Gary Baca for his production support today. Our theme song is The Overture from Summer Night's Dream by Marcel Khalife.